Well, you'll be very happy that you came today because Rick Green, who teaches about the Constitution, is with us. As you know, we've been in quite a struggle here in the state of Hawaii, trying to keep our moorings and our foundations from crumbling because of the many voices that come in, and then the liberalness of our country, that everything's changing. The moral landscape is changing. But if we forget who we are and why we are here and what started us in the first place, then our identity will be slowly stripped from us and a new identity will be put on us, whether you realize it or not. And you'll wake up one day and think, I don't like this, but it's already there. Unless you continue with frequent recurrence to be reminded of who we are and where did we come from. You see, it's so easy for us, quick to forget why the pilgrims left Europe to come here. And when they landed at the Pilgrim's Rock, at the Mayflower, and coming in, you'll remember that they came because they were seeking freedom of worship, so they could live what they believed. They couldn't. They could believe over there, but they couldn't live it. So they came here for freedom of worship. And then our forefathers. Some time ago, CNN broke a story that four huge sequoia trees had fallen down in a less than intense windstorm. These giant guardians of the forest, who set its roots down before the United States ever became a nation, had toppled. After a lengthy investigation, they came to the park ranger, Deb Schweitzer, and said, what was the reason for this? And you know what she said? She said it was from root erosion. Root erosion, they said, yes. You see, from people coming, tourists will come, and not just by ones or twos, but by the thousands, whether it's a high school excursion trip, grade school kids, etc., coming, and they walk around the base of the tree, and they look at this majestic, spiring miracle. And they're oohing and awing, but not one, not two, 1,000, 2,000, not just one time, but every day, day after day, year after year. And with all of the foot traffic, it begins to erode the roots. And that which was once compacted no longer is. It's loosened. And with a slight wind, all four of them crashed. What's the remedy? Was the question. She said, now we're building enclosures around the root system of all of these trees that are frequently being visited so that we must protect the roots. She called it like a sacred enclosure. Because if the root systems ever lose its strength, the trees will be about to die. Same is true with the United States of America. Our root system has to have a sacred enclosure around it so that we don't, in some way, cause erosion to take place. But that's exactly what's happening today. So I thought we need to go back to the roots of who we are, lest we forget, lest we become a people that we never intended to be and what our forefathers never intended for us to become. In fact, they put in place safeguards so it doesn't happen. What's happening to those safeguards? What's happening to the guardrails? Well, I couldn't think of a better person to help us to understand this than Rick Green. Rick Green works with wall builders. He also, he and Dave Barton and a few others have started something to develop the young people into government. Patriots Academy is a group of young people that actually train to learn how to understand the Constitution, our laws, and how to, with diplomacy, make sure that our laws are just laws, because there can be unjust laws as well. So Rick Green conceded to come, and we are very, very glad that he's here. So would you give a very warm welcome to Rick Green as he comes? Rick.
Thank you, bro. Appreciate it, man. Well, good morning, everybody. I'm surprised y'all would invite a Texas politician back. I mean, politicians don't have the best reputation in the world. I used to serve in the legislature back in Texas, so I can tell you I'm actually not a politician anymore. I'm now a recovering politician. We have a great Tuesday night meeting back home. You know, we get together, get up and say, hi, I'm Rick. I'm a recovering politician. I'm 3 years clean off the ballot, just so you know. So things are going well in the Green household. I think we do get cynical about politicians. I was that way when I went into office. I remember taking the oath there on the floor of the Texas House, and I'm standing there, and my wife's there, and we had one son at the time, my parents, my pastor was right there beside me as I took the oath. I think because he was there, I don't know, I had a dream that night. We ended up in heaven on the same day, and we're getting the tour together. And we get to this little shack, little one-bedroom deal, and little cot, little desk, that's all there is to it. And St. Peter says to my pastor, Brother Dickey, this will be your home here in heaven. So, of course, my first selfish thought is, man, if the preacher's getting that, I must be in trouble because I'm going to get something a lot worse. But we get around the corner, big, huge mansion, all that stuff you dream of as a kid. And he says, Rick, this will be your home here in heaven. And I said, well, now, wait, why does that good and holy man get that little shack and I get this mansion? He said, well, you know, son, you hadn't been here long. You don't know how it works. He said, we got all the preachers up here we want. You're the first politician ever made it. Thought we'd do something nice, you know. So, I mean, that's kind of the way we think about these guys and gals. But, you know, here's the great thing. We always have the leaders we deserve, and we can change the character of our Congress and our legislature if we'll just show up and vote our values. So we complain about what happens in Washington or what happens in our state legislature, but the truth is the buck stops with us. And if we want to see godly men and women in office, we got to go make that happen, and we can. Wouldn't it be great to see some men and women of righteous character and of biblical values serving us in the state legislature and in Washington, D.C.? Wouldn't you like to see that? We can make that happen. We're given the power to do that in our founding documents. We, the people, are in charge. So when the Bible says to us, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's, Caesar in America, guess who's Caesar in America? Can you tell me who Caesar is in America? It's not the president. Who? The people. There we go. Get this guy a cookie. Getting cookies back there? Good answer. It's exactly right. You, if nothing else, come to my table and get a free book. How's that? All right. It's exactly right. We the people, we are Caesar. So how do you render unto Caesar what is Caesar's if you're Caesar? You do your job as a citizen. You just get engaged in the process. So let's talk about what that process is. These guys founded the most successful nation in the history of the world. Bar none, the wealthiest, the most powerful. Now, I'm not saying that from an arrogant point, you know, America's better than everybody else. American exceptionalism is a phrase coined by Alexis de Tocqueville. So if a Frenchman gave us a phrase, it must not be bragging. Plus, my mom always said, if it's true, it ain't bragging. So the truth is, we have become the most powerful, the wealthiest nation in history. That didn't happen by accident. You don't become wealthy by accident. There's a cause for that effect. You don't become powerful by accident. There's a cause for that effect. And by the way, our power as a nation has always been used to free and liberate people, not conquer and subdue. We use the atomic bomb not to hurt people, but to end a war. We end up saving millions of lives as a result of that and ending that war. Ask anyone that served on Iwo Jima, Saipan, any of the Pacific Islands, had to actually go into Japan, they'll tell you. We ended up saving millions of lives as a result. So we've used that power and that benevolence to serve others around the world. Why? What is it about the formula for America that would cause us to do the things that we've done? Why do we show up to help people around the world so often? There's something about what these guys did that is very different and very unique. And in order to find that, we got to go back to the founding documents. We got to look right there in the Declaration of Independence for the birth certificate of America. And right there in the birth certificate, oh, that's not the birth certificate. I'm talking about the birth certificate. There's some guy on the screen. Who's this guy? That's George Mason, actually. He's a framer of the Constitution, one of the 55 guys that framed it, and not one of the 39 that signed. This man refused to sign the Constitution because it was missing the Bill of Rights. We didn't have the Bill of Rights initially. He said, I'm not going to sign without that. So then he gets elected to Congress, the first Congress under the Constitution, and he comes in with Madison and pushes through our Bill of Rights. That's why he's known as the father of the Bill of Rights. So here's why I had him up there, because he gave us some great advice on returning to our principles. He said that no free government or the blessings of liberty can be preserved to any people but by a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. How many of you want to be free? You like being free? Okay. How many of you want the blessings of liberty? Anybody out there? All right. If we want those two things, what do? We have a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. So 4 years ago when I was with you, we talked about the Declaration of Independence. We talked about the frame of America. We talked about those basic principles that made America great. So today we're going to have a frequent recurrence. We're going to come back and remind you of some of those principles and try to go a little bit deeper. It all starts right here in the Declaration of Independence with those precious 56 words that make up what I call the frame of America. That frame is holding your picture in place. Now, your picture might be different than mine. Okay, that was just a nice picture I thought kind of depicted American freedom. Maybe for you, it's your family, picture of your church, picture of your community, whatever it is. Take a picture in your mind of what you depict freedom as, put that picture up in the frame, and know this. If the frame goes, your picture is going with it. My picture's going with it. We will lose all those things we hold dear about being free. So the first thing we got to know is what's in the frame. What is it that works so well for America? But this time around, I brought some help. So y'all welcome two of my boys, Reagan and Rhett Green, are going to come out and help us. Come on out, guys. All right, so Reagan's going to start us. He's going to share those 56 words with you. Then they'll explain the four principles we're going to talk about this morning. Go ahead.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator, not their commissioner, not their president, not even my dad, especially not the Supreme Court justice. It says they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
In the words of the Declaration, there are four basic principles that make up the frame of America. First, the Founding Fathers began with the basic idea that truth is real. It is obvious and it does not change.
Second, they made it clear that God is the source of freedom. It's just like the Declaration says, our rights don't come from any elected or appointed officials. They come from God Almighty.
Third, the just powers of government can only come from the consent of the governed. That's you and me. The word consent is used 3 times in the Declaration and 11 times in the Constitution. Obviously, the Founding Fathers didn't want the government's use of power without a consent. They wanted us to always remember, the government's use of power without our consent is tyranny.
Now, the last part of the frame is the pursuit of happiness. This is the free enterprise system that has made America the most successful nation in history. Thomas Jefferson once said, a wise and frugal government which shall leave men free to regulate their own pursuit of industry and improvement and shall not take from the mouth of labor bread it has earned, this is the sum of good government.
Now let's all do our part to preserve those four principles. Welcome back, my dad.
Good job, guys. Way to go. All right. We're trying to help these shy, poorly socialized homeschoolers come out of their shell. So that's why we're doing that. It's getting a little better. Anyway, so here's the deal. All right, they mentioned those four principles to you. Think about what they said, because a lot of what they were saying actually comes from religious and moral values. When we talk about we hold these truths to be self-evident, that means there's a right and a wrong, moral absolutes, not moral relativism. You know, the idea today is everybody do whatever feels good, do whatever's right in your own eyes. The founders said we hold these truths to be self-evident. So they believed in right and wrong. The idea that they said there's a creator and that creator is the source of our freedom, that set up the philosophy for how our system works. It means that government doesn't give you your freedom. Government doesn't give you your rights. Your neighbor does not give you your freedom or give you your rights. It's not dependent upon them. Our freedom comes from God. That's a very important concept that we need to remember out of the Declaration of Independence. Now, some people say, well, now, wait, none of this could be true because all the Founding Fathers were atheists. They were agnostics. They were deists. They didn't believe in having God in the equation. In fact, isn't that what made America special? Somehow we separated religion and morality from our government. We're told that we have supposedly a godless constitution, that these guys gave us a godless document, and that's why America is successful. And I hear these things, and I hear professors say them, I see people talk about it on television, and then I start thinking, well, you know, that's what they're saying the Founding Fathers said and did. Why don't I actually go read the Founding Fathers themselves? Because when I read the Founding Fathers themselves, when I read the founding documents, when I read what the founders said about the founding documents, when I watch what the founders did in terms of the laws that they passed, the way that they acted, the things that they quoted, I get a very, very different picture than folks like this have painted for us with regard to the Founding Fathers. And so that's what I want to try to capture for you this morning, is the Founding Fathers of America and what they gave us in our principles and how we can keep those principles alive for our children and grandchildren. Now that presents a bit of a challenge because there are 250 men considered to be the Founding Fathers of America. So I hope you don't have any plans this afternoon. I think I can be done by midnight if y'all are willing to. I'm kidding. All right, well, I'm hungry too. So no, we're not going to do that. However, we are going to cover as many guys as we possibly can, which means I'm going to ratchet this thing up. David Barton and I get accused of talking about 90 words a minute with gusts up to about 350. So this is the point where we're going to gust on up to 350. So buckle up. I've been going really slow up until this moment. Okay, so get ready to speed up a little bit more. So the good news is that everything I'm about to say and do is on that DVD out there at the table, is America One Nation Under God. The bad news is that DVD, just as fast as what we're about to do. So Hope you know where that rewind button is on your DVD player. Let's start with this fellow right here, George Washington, father of the country. You want to know if any founding father was a man of faith? Real simple. Go talk to their friends. Go interview the people that spent time with them. We can do that by reading their journals. We can do that by reading their correspondence back and forth. These guys love writing letters to each other. Man, they wrote letters to each other like you and I text each other today. Thousands and thousands, volumes of letters. We can go read that and read the journals. And I love reading the journals of guys like General Henry Knox, because here's a guy that actually served side by side with Washington throughout the war, with him for much of the 7 years. And while he's doing that, he gets to observe Washington up close. And in Knox's journal, over and over again, we find him saying, well, today I accidentally interrupted the general again, walked in on his tent. Guess what he was doing? He was praying right there in his tent. General Knox said that happened all the time. Got to Congress and President Washington. Now it's Secretary Thompson that walks in on President Washington, accidentally interrupting him. Guess what he's doing? And it's going to be that same answer every time if everybody else wants to jump in with me here. It'll be fun. Anyway, yes, he's praying right there in Congress. Same thing at Valley Forge. You go to Valley Forge, big bronze monument, George Washington is. Then you go right down the street. There's a chapel at Valley Forge, stained glass window of George Washington praying. You get to Washington, D.C., in the very prayer room of our congressman right now on federal property in the chapel at Washington, D.C. at the United States Capitol building. Is George Washington, what's he doing? We've all seen the paintings of Washington praying. I just think it's amazing that an atheist founding father spent that much time praying. I mean, think about it. If we people of faith would spend half as much time praying as these atheists did, we'd be a lot better off in our country, don't you think? Let's find out what this atheist founding father had to say about religion and morality in our culture. He gave us a hint about how to be free, how to continue to be free. He actually told us there's a secret sauce to the American formula. And he said, of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity. Notice he said political, not personal. So this isn't just in our own private prayer life or church life. This is publicly in the public square and in our government. Of all the habits and dispositions which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. He's saying if you want to be successful as a nation, don't let religion and morality be removed from the formula. If you take them out of the formula, if you radically transform America's formula into something that doesn't have religion and morality at the center of it, you'll lose all those freedoms. In fact, a lot of my friends don't like that. They say, Rick, I'm a patriot. I'm with you on freedom. I'll fight for liberty. But I don't want you talking about God. I don't want you bringing the Bible into this. I don't want religion and morality. I can be a patriot without any of that. I say, well, father of the country, you remember him, George Washington? He disagrees with you. He said, in vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism that would work to subvert these great pillars of religion and morality. He's saying you cannot remove these things from the culture and call yourself a patriot because you're actually working to destroy the nation. You're destroying our foundation. You're destroying the roots that Pastor Wayne was talking about. So that's what we don't want to do. And that's why we have to warn people to say, look, I'm all for liberty. I'm all for freedom. I'm all for revolution with ballots, not bullets, and working to get our nation back to a constitutional republic. But don't buy into a lot of this liberty without God mentality. There's a lot of folks out there pushing that right now. And they're all about liberty and freedom, but they want God out of the equation. Don't buy into that. We can't go down that road. And you know why he was so smart about that? The reason he was concerned about it is when he gives this speech, he's watching the French Revolution. And the French Revolution was trying to duplicate the American Revolution, but they made a very big mistake and a distinction in their idea of liberty. American Revolution was all about liberty under God, liberty from God, God at the center of the equation. The French Revolution was all about liberty without God. Killed all the priests, removed religion from society. What happened? It led to chaos. It led to the guillotine. It was a horrible form of government and a horrible form of revolution. And Washington did not want us to make the same mistake. So don't let people convince you that separating religion and morality from our government is somehow going to make us stronger. It will destroy us. Take a look at some of these other guys. Abraham Baldwin, founder of the University of Georgia. This guy was offered a professorship of divinity at the age of 21. He was a chaplain in the Revolutionary War for 7 years. We couldn't find any people of faith to be chaplains for, so we had to get atheist founding fathers to do that. Because he's in Constitution, they're all atheists. It was a joke. Anyway, all right, so he's not really an atheist, okay? He's really a man of faith, and he's one of the guys giving us the Constitution. This guy here, Rufus King, was an original manager of the American Bible Society. Two of the founders of the American Bible Society, right there in the room with him, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney and John Langdon. Wait a minute, these guys are starting a Bible society? What's the purpose of a Bible society? Spread the Word of God. Study the Word of God. That's an interesting activity for a bunch of atheist founding fathers. In fact, if we put the other picture up there, the signers of the Declaration, 29 of the 56 signers of the Declaration held what we would call today seminary degrees. That's pretty good to get a bunch of atheists to go to seminary. I mean, it must have been nothing else to do in 1776, because they certainly wouldn't have actually believed any of that stuff. All right, James McHenry started the Baltimore Bible Society, now known as the Maryland Bible Society. Gouverneur Morris, most active man in that room. He speaks more on the Constitution than anybody. 173 times he rose at the convention to influence the document we live under in our government today. In fact, he wrote the preamble entirely by himself, and he's known as the penman of the Constitution. So I'd say this guy probably knew what the Constitution was intended to do or not intended to do. Here's what he said about our education and religion. He said, "Religion is the only solid basis of good morals. Therefore, education should teach the precepts of religion and the duties of man towards God." You say, wait, Rick, hang on, wait. Supreme Court says education and religion. We got to keep those as far apart as possible because of the Constitution. I'm just wondering if it's the same Constitution this guy gave us. Because he's telling us keep education and religion side by side, working together, influencing, religion influencing that education. Now, how about the law and religion? This fellow over here on the right is James Wilson. He's the second most active member of the convention. He speaks 168 times at the Constitutional Convention. And not only did he sign the Constitution, he also signed the Declaration of Independence. So he gives us both of our founding documents. He actually served on the Supreme Court, first guy George Washington nominates to serve on the court. So this is a very influential man and probably the best expert on the Constitution that we could talk about. He said human law. Think about what human law is. That's what our city council does. That's what our legislature does. That's what Congress does. All of our laws that we pass, our human laws, he said of those laws, they should be they rest their ultimate authority on the higher law. Now, what's he saying? He's saying that divine law, the authority of that higher law, is where you must get your foundation for your civil laws, your criminal laws, everything your legislature does. And if you leave out that higher law, that divine law, the Bible is what he's referring to. He does a whole deal on the laws of nature and nature's God out of the Declaration, not some New Age thing that said anybody can believe whatever they want. That was specifically, he said, Romans 1, that God's revealed himself to us in nature, and he's revealed himself to us in the Word of God. So they were specifically talking about the Christian religion, and he's saying our laws should be based upon that, and if they're not, you're going to run into chaos. He said, in fact, religion, far from being rivals or enemies, religion and law are twin sisters, friends, mutual assistants. Indeed, these two sciences run into each other, not meaning a head-on collision like we had today when religion and law get mixed together. I mean, we throw out jury decisions. We throw out all kinds of things when religion is allowed to even be spoken of in the area of law. And that's exactly the opposite of what he's saying. He's saying they work together side by side like a couple of oxen pulling together to give us a good culture. Now, think about what that means to us in some of the debates that we're having today. In fact, in your own state right now, the debate over same-sex marriage versus natural marriage. I mean, think about what he's saying. He's saying that our law, our human law, should be based on the higher law. That's why I would say you must define marriage as one man and one woman. Because not only do we learn in the laws of nature that that's the right way to do it, but also in nature's God, in his laws and what he tells us. And that's what James Wilson is saying. That's why when people say to me, well, Rick, you know, this business is trying to define marriage as one man and one woman, you can't do that because that's bringing the Bible into government. I've got, I think, a really good response to that. Yep. Because that's what the Founding Fathers told us to do, to make sure that religion and morality, that higher law is the foundation of what we do, and that we don't ignore that, but we actually build upon that and keep that strength going forward in our nation. We could go through these guys one by one. Roger Sherman, Jacob Broom, John Dickinson, those are major theologians of the day. Let me just tell you, out of 250 Founding Fathers, 95% of them are outspoken Christians. They live it, they talk it, they wrote it. There's no denying it. There are 10 guys out of 250 founders that I do have to take off the table and tell you they're not Christians. 10 out of 250, that's only 5%. But by the way, the ones I'm taking off the table, they are not atheists, they are not agnostics, they are not deists. They believe in God, they believe in the hand of providence, they believe God's involved in our daily lives, but they do not believe Jesus to be the Son of God. So I can't call them Christians, but they're certainly not anti-religious. They're certainly not anti-God. They actually believe in God. And one of them, Benjamin Franklin, is the one at the Constitutional Convention when everything was falling apart 5 weeks into the convention. He's the one that stands up and reminds them, how could you guys forget that we won the war because God obviously showed up in the things that we were doing because we were praying every day for that. We need to be praying every day while we're trying to form this Constitution. That's the least religious founding father. And he's telling these guys they ought to be praying in Congress. I mean, we've gone so far off the tracks because we've been lied to about what these guys actually said, did, and believed. Now you might say, okay, fine, Rick, I believe you. All right, all these guys, or most of these guys, without question, men of faith. But they didn't put it in the Constitution. There's nothing about God in the Constitution, and that's why this godless Constitution theory is right. Well, actually, when you read the founders, they'll show you clause by clause out of the Constitution, they trace back to the Bible. They'll give you chapter and verse on where they got the concept from. So even the idea of separation of powers, yes, that comes out of Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws, but they said we're going back even further to Jeremiah 17:9. I just need one breath, and then we'll be able to make it the rest of the way. Actually, I might need one more. So Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is evil. No man can know it. The depravity of man. So in other words, what the founders were saying, if the heart's evil and you don't even know the evil in your own heart, then if we make you king today, it might be great today, but that evil's eventually going to come out. And if there's no checks and balances, no separation of powers, then that evil is going to turn into tyranny. We've watched it happen throughout history. So the founders said, we'll prevent that by having this separation of powers and checks and balances. That way we spread that power out, and if there is evil coming forth out of a public official, we have these checks and balances to be able to shut that down and get them removed and get somebody else in that office. Even our Republican form of government. We're not a democracy. We're a republic. And they told us where they got the idea from. It's right out of Exodus. Choose out from among you leaders of tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. That's right out of Exodus. What is that? Local, county, state, federal government. We got it out of the Bible. We even got our instructions on how to choose those leaders out of that same chapter where it talks about choosing able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness. So when you choose your leaders, when you go in to vote, you're looking for somebody that is capable of doing the job. That's the first quality listed. Interesting. You're looking for somebody that's honest. You're looking for somebody that fears God and that doesn't hates covetousness, doesn't want the job so they can just get the perks of the job. So those are the things we should measure our candidates by. That doesn't mean we go in and say, well, none of the candidates meet that criteria, so I'm going home. I'm not even going to vote. Or like some of my friends, I'll say, well, Rick, I'm just going to sit in this one out this year because I will not vote for the lesser of two evils. To which I always respond, well, unless Jesus Christ is on the ballot this year, you're going to vote for the lesser of two evils. Because there is none righteous, no, not one. Not one of us is perfect, are we? Right? We're all flawed jars of clay. You're never going to find a candidate you agree with 100% of the time. I've never found, I don't even agree with myself 100% of the time. How am I going to find a candidate? There is one person I agree with 100% of the time. You know who it is? It's my wife. Because whether she's right or wrong, she's right. You know what I'm saying? All right, so I'm not stupid. I've been married long enough to figure that one out. But you're never going to find a candidate that's perfect. Hey, would you do me a favor when you are choosing those candidates that you want to go support? Don't ask them, well, do they agree with the Republican Party platform 100% of the time? Do they agree with the Democrat Party platform 100%? How about we start saying, how well do they match up with the Bible? Do they have a biblical worldview? Do they agree with us on the biblical values? Did what Pastor Wayne preached on last Sunday or the Sunday before or a month ago or whatever it is, where do they stand on that issue? Because, see, that's how we ought to measure the candidate. It's not about party. It's about principle. So sometimes it might be the Republican. Sometimes it might be the Democrat. Sometimes it might be the Independent Constitutional Party, Daffy Duck Party. I don't care what the party is. What I'm interested in is do they have the principles that will return us to the foundation that makes the nation great. So pay attention to those things, but use that biblical command for how to choose those candidates. So the question is, how did they come to this conclusion it's a godless constitution? Well, I don't have an answer for you, because when you go to the back of their book, they don't give you any evidence. All they tell you is, we've dispensed with the normal scholarly method of endnotes because what we're saying is so well known, just trust us on this. I don't trust them. How about you? You don't have to trust them. You don't have to trust me. You don't have to trust David Barton. Go to the founding fathers themselves. Go read that. It's so much easier today to study these things than ever before in our history. You can just get online and do it. Even this phrase right here. How many times you heard that phrase? Separation of church and state. They use it to get religion out of schools. They use it to keep kids from praying in schools. They use it to arrest pastors on a public sidewalk reading a Bible. They use it for all kinds of things. I speak on law school campuses. I get the class. I say, okay, put that slide up there. I say, I hear this phrase all the time. Where is it? What founding document contains separation of church and state? There's always a student say, Declaration of Independence. No, it's not there. Read through it. 27 grievances against King George, not one time separation of church and state. What's in the Constitution? No, it's not in the Constitution. Yeah, it is. No, it's not. Yeah, it is. No, it's not. Yeah, it is. Argue for a little bit, and then finally I say, what's in the First Amendment? First Amendment, separation of church and state. I just had it in my con law class. I know it's there. I say, okay, we'll open the First Amendment and read it to me. Well, they don't give us constitutions here at law school. They just tell us what to think about the Constitution or what some judge said about the Constitution. I said, how about this? How about we read the actual Constitution? Let's break that out. So I give them all a pocket Constitution. I say, open it up and let's read the First Amendment. What's it say? Congress shall make no law respecting an established religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Anybody see separation? How about church? State? Not there. Well, there's always at least one student says, well, it doesn't say that, but separation of church and state, that's what they meant. So, okay, well, while we're reading their minds, why don't we do this the right way? It's what we call legislative intent. We can get inside the heads of legislators to try to figure out what did they mean by all that gobbledygook and legal mumbo jumbo that's in the statute. And they always explain it right there on the floor. So this is the Texas House. Back when I was there, that's you stood right up here and you laid out your bill and you wax eloquent about how the world can't survive without this piece of legislation. Then your buddies go down here, there's a back mic you can't see, and they all toss you softball questions so you can sound real smart. That's how everybody does it. Anyway, so after you get done sounding real smart, everything you say goes in the journal. Why do you want all that in the journal? Because someday somebody's going to argue about what that law really means. One side's going to say it means this, the other side's going to say it means that, and then somebody's going to pull that journal out and say, well, now, wait a minute. The guys that actually passed that law said what it means. They gave us the intent. They opened up their mind and showed us what the law is supposed to do, not supposed to do, how far it's supposed to go, how far it's not supposed to go. So we can figure out what the law is intended to do. Same thing with the Constitution, same thing with the First Amendment. Because the Constitution requires everything said on the floor of the House, floor of the Senate, it's going to go in the journal. Well, let's go back to the journal. They debated the First Amendment for weeks and weeks and weeks. And during all of that debate, in all of that journal, how many times do we see the phrase separation of church and state? Zero. Not one time. You say, well, wait. If separation of church and state is what they meant by the First Amendment, then surely these guys were repeating that over. No, not one time. Go back to the Constitutional Convention. Not one time. You will not see the phrase separation of church and state for more than a decade after the Constitution's ratified. It was one founding father in one letter, not an official act, not a law, not a court decision, none of that. It was one letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists. He used the phrase to describe to the Baptists, don't worry, the state will never stop you from living out your faith. The First Amendment was designed to prohibit the government, not prohibit the citizen. But today we've taken his phrase, changed the meaning of it, completely turned the First Amendment upside down, and now we prohibit the citizen instead of prohibiting the state. It's the opposite of what the founding fathers intended. And honestly, we shouldn't be quoting Jefferson with the First Amendment anyway, because he had nothing to do with the First Amendment. So that's the wrong head to be cracking open if you want the original intent of the First Amendment. He wasn't there. In fact, he told a biographer that said, hey, everybody says you wrote the Constitution. He said, nope, I was in Europe when the Constitution was planned, never even saw it till after it was established. Wrong guy to be going to as an expert on the Constitution. You should go to guys like James Madison. Madison was there, and he said, all we're trying to prevent is a single national denomination. Church of England, right? That's what we don't want. You don't believe me. You don't want it where if I get elected president, everybody's got to join my particular denomination, or you get elected for everybody. We don't want that. Nobody wants that. We want an institutional separation of church and state, but that does not mean that we in the church have to stay away from the state. It's the opposite of that. The state cannot come into the church, but we in the church absolutely should be influencing what's happening out there. So how did we get this far off track? How did we allow things in the Constitution to get twisted and turned without ever actually amending the Constitution and then start seeing our freedoms being taken away? And if you don't believe that, you ought to listen to Wall Builders Live. At least once a week, we're doing a program that has something to do with some pastor being arrested or some member of the military. Now there's a guy being court-martialed right now simply because he disagreed with a commander over the same-sex marriage. I mean, it has gone off the rails, folks, with what's happening in our country, and it's because of abuse of our constitutional freedoms. And by the way, just on this faith element, because a lot of people talk about Jefferson's faith and whether or not he was a Christian, and he has an interesting life. You really have to study his whole life and not just one particular area of his life. But here's what Jefferson said about our concept of keeping God in the equation of our freedom. He said, can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we remove their only firm basis? So here's Thomas Jefferson. He's about to tell us what the firm basis of liberty is. A conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they're not to be violated, but with his wrath indeed I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever. So Thomas Jefferson is telling us that the firm basis of liberty is for all of us to remember that our freedom comes from God, not government. That our freedom comes from God, not our neighbor. And therefore, we have to remember that if our freedom comes from God, we got to live out that freedom respecting his authority. He said that's what makes us special. The fact that God's in the equation, it causes us to act differently than we would if God wasn't in the equation. Instead of just going and doing whatever feels good and whatever's right in our own eyes, we're living our freedom respecting the authority of God. Back to this question of how we got off track and how we get back on track. Jefferson gave us some advice on that as well. You look at all these abuses of the Constitution, look at what Jefferson said. I know no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves. That's us. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the corrective of abuses of constitutional power. So what's he saying? study. He's saying that we, the people, have to get educated about our freedoms. If you want to keep your freedom, in fact, that's a good question. What is your freedom worth to you? Better question, what's your child's freedom worth to you? See, if we really care about preserving these things, we really care about being able to worship God as we choose, we care about not having government come in and tell us we can't worship God the way we want. If we really care about it, we need to pay attention to it and say, what do I need to do to protect and preserve that freedom for future generations? And Jefferson's saying the first thing you got to do is just study. Just get educated about the Constitution so that you can recognize when your rights are violated. In fact, I like the way John Jay put it. He uses those exact words. He says, every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution and teach the rising generation to be free. By knowing their rights, they will sooner perceive when they've been violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. So if we want to defend and assert our rights, if we want to preserve that freedom for future generations, he said, read and study the Constitution. Now, don't worry. I mean, look, I know you're not going to go spend 5 years, you know, like some monk with the Constitution. I'm going to become an expert on every little, I read every Supreme Court decision. I know you're not going to do that. I don't expect you to do that. I want you to do the same thing you do when you buy a new gadget. Now you're thinking, well, how is that connected? All right, here's how it's connected. Think about it when you get home with that big screen TV or that new computer or your new phone. They always come with a big, thick user's manual, right? What do you do with the big, thick user's manual? Chunk it, right? You're not going to go read every book ever written on that gadget to try to figure out how to make that thing work. What you're looking for is the same thing I'm looking for when I take a new gadget home. I want that nice, fold-out, four-color, with pictures, glossy, quick start guide, right? All I want to know is how do I plug this thing in and turn it on? I don't care how it works. I just want it to work. Okay, same thing with the Constitution and with our liberty and our freedom. We all have lives that we're, you know, living. We all have jobs. We all have families we're raising, things that we're doing. So you're not going to go spend, 5 years studying on the Constitution. So what we did was we created a quick start guide to the Constitution. Very simple and actually very fun. We went back to Independence Hall, the very room where the Constitution was framed. And in that room where these guys debated the Constitution, also where they signed the Declaration of Independence, we created a quick start guide for citizens on how to get engaged and how to protect and preserve the Constitution. So get that package and open up your home, bring in friends and family, do it in your Sunday school class. It's got about 11 chapters, about 30 minutes each. You go through those. Brad Stein, the comedian, came in and did part of it with us, so it'd be fun. My kids do a lot of the teaching. Believe me, it'll be fun, it'll be exciting. More importantly, it'll teach you what you need to know to save our country. It's not boring constitutional law kind of stuff. It's exciting citizen action, things that you can do to save the country. And if you want to do a live class, we're going to do one next Monday over at New Hope Leeward. So if you want to join us on Monday evening, we're going to do an abbreviated version of the class over there at New Hope Leeward. So here's the deal, guys. We are the salt of the earth. This song from Matthew West, I think, says it so well. But we are the salt of the earth, but we're not going to change the world by sitting still, all right? We are that city on a hill, but we're not going to change the world and save our freedom by just sitting still. We got to get engaged. We got to stand up. We got to engage in this process and influence the world around us, specifically the church. We in the church have got to accept our duty and responsibility to be salt and light out there. That fellow right there is Charles Finney. That's not John Travolta. I'm sorry for the confusion with the move, but it is a pretty good staying alive move. If it was a white suit, it would look a lot better. But all the older people got that. I noticed there weren't many laughing at that. So anyway, this is not John Travolta, but I do think I figured this out, though, and it was coming to Hawaii that gave me the revelation last night. That is a spirit-filled Pentecostal Hawaiian luau. It's kind of, we just need the skirt. Now, anyway, so the point is, it's Charles Finney. But Charles Finney put it this way. He said, the church, now get this, if you don't get anything else I said today, please get this. The church, that's us, must take right ground in regard to politics. Politics are part, when you say politics, just think government. Just think our government, right? Politics are part of a religion in a country such as this, and Christians must do their duty to their country as a part of their duty to God. He said, God will bless or curse his nation according to the course Christians take in politics. What he's saying is government, politics, that's just a part of our life. We live in a free society, and we get to choose our leaders, and it's our responsibility to do that. And so that's just an extension of our faith. No different than if you run a business, hopefully you run that business based on your principles from the Bible. If you are a teacher, or you're an educator, or you're a parent, or whatever it is, the Bible influences how you do that, right? Same thing with our government. Our government should be influenced by that biblical worldview of how to make the system work best. That's how the founding fathers of America did it. And if we'll choose leaders like that again today, we'll get it back on track. Proverbs tells us, But when the righteous rule, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. So in America, who chooses whether we're going to be ruled by the righteous or the wicked?
Us,
that's right, we do. That's the second cookie for you. That's a good, yeah, this guy's on top of things, man. We get to choose. And you don't think about it. Most people that ever lived on the planet did not get to do that. They didn't get to choose their leaders. Most people that ever lived on this planet, they only knew tyranny and oppression. We live in pretty good times, folks. We can complain about a lot of the bad. We still got it better than most people that ever lived on the planet. But if we don't exercise those freedoms, if we keep choosing the opposite of righteousness, we're going to end up with wickedness only in our country, and we're going to lose those freedoms. We've seen it happen in history before. Let's not make that mistake. The system works, but we have to work it. And that's consent of the governed. That's standing up and saying, I give my consent or I refuse my consent. State of Hawaii is considering adopting same-sex marriage instead of natural marriage, changing the definition of marriage. The church has to stand up and say, I refuse my consent. Each of us as citizens has the right to call those legislators and let our voice be heard and let our values be counted. If we're silent, believe me, government will assume you've consented because they're going to hear from the other side. If we're silent, then we lose those battles. We have to engage by giving or refusing that consent. And of course, the most important way to do that is every chance you get to go to the ballot box and cast your vote. The Constitution gives us specific protections on our right to be able to vote. And I'm going to get one more of my kiddos to come out. And we're almost done. That means we're circling at this point. Doesn't mean we're landing, but we could land at any time. So go ahead and make your reservation at the restaurant. Cameron, come on out. This is my baby girl, Cameron. She's going to help us with the voting amendments in the Constitution. All right, baby. All yours.
There are four amendments that protect our right to vote. The 15th Amendment guarantees that we can vote no matter what the color of our skin. The 26th Amendment says you must be at least 18 years old to vote, so that means I've still got 6 more years to go. Amendment 24 protects the right to vote whether we're rich or poor. And last is my personal favorite. The 19th Amendment makes sure that we ladies have the same rights as the guys when choosing our leaders. Our right to vote is protected throughout the Constitution, so do not waste it. Every chance you get to vote, let your voice be heard and values counted.
Excellent job. All right. Can you tell she's my favorite? So we don't have, she's the only girl. We got one more boy as well. He's out there at the book table, but that means three boys and one girl, or as we call them, the queen and her subjects. That's pretty much how it works out at home. So anyway, look, guys, don't waste this. Cameron's right. Man, don't bury your talent. God's given you the ability to choose your leaders. Please let your voice be heard. I'm going to leave you with a story about these guys right here because I want to challenge you to be willing to pledge, like they did, your life, your fortune, and sacred honor. And I'm not asking you to give all of it. I'm just asking you to give a little bit of it in order to preserve and pass on the torch of freedom. And I want to take you back, get my little time machine with me. We're going to go back in time to that room on August 2nd, 1776. You say, wait, I thought it was July 4th. No, July 4th, only Hancock sitting there and Thompson standing there signed the Declaration. Goes out to the world. Then these guys come back into the room on August 2nd for the purpose of actually putting their name on the document, knowing that that would be a bounty on their head, that that was a message to King George to come and get them. So they gathered in the room, and according to Benjamin Rush in his letters, he said that it was totally silent. No one said a word. As Secretary Thompson, from the front of the room with the declaration laid out, the silver inkwell and two feathered pens, he began to call them forward. He started over on his right with the delegation from New Hampshire, and he said, Josiah Bartlett of New Hampshire. And Bartlett got up, he came forward, and in total silence, he dipped that pen in the ink, and he signed the Declaration of Independence, went back and sat down. One by one, they came. John Hart of New Jersey gets up, comes forward, takes a pen, dips it in the ink. You can literally hear in that little room the pen scratching along the surface of the Declaration. Goes back, sits down. Everybody coming, one by one. No one says anything until Elbridge Gerry is called forward. Now, you may not know that name. Elbridge Gerry is not a well-known founding father. He did go on to become vice president, but most of us don't know him. All you need to know about Gerry for this particular story is that he was a little guy. All right, Elbridge Gerry was the smallest of the founders. He was not the towering, seven-foot Thor-like figure that is standing before you speaking at the moment. He was, what are you laughing at? Okay, seriously, I'm a little guy, all right? I'm 5'7" and 3/4" with my boots on, right? So, I mean, I'm a little guy. Gerry was about 6 inches shorter than I am, all right? So he's a little guy, smallest of the founders. He comes up, he takes the pen, he's about to sign. And over here in the back of the room is Colonel Benjamin Harrison. And Harrison is the biggest, the largest of the founders. I mean, he was huge. And he decides he's going to break the silence of the most important political moment in history with these words. Gerry's about to sign, little guy up front, big guy says, I shall have a great advantage over you, Mr. Jerry, when we're hung for what we're now doing. He said, by the size and great weight of my body, well, I'll be dead within a minute or two. By the lightness of yours, you're going to dance in the air for an hour or more before you finally die. True story. Only words spoken during the signing of our Declaration of Independence. Aren't you glad I shared that story with you this morning? I love the story because it's funny, but I also love it because it drives home the fact that they knew what they were doing. In fact, Benjamin Rush said that everybody laughed whenever he said that, including Jerry, and then everybody got real quiet as it dawned on them what Harrison was saying. He was saying to them, you are signing your death warrant, and very soon we will all die as a result of what we're doing. And it didn't happen to all of them. Nine of them did not survive. There were several that lost their wives. In fact, Elizabeth Lewis was the wife of Francis Lewis. When the British caught up to their home, he wasn't there, and she was. They start firing cannons at the house, a cannonball. They're going to burn her house. She stands on the front porch and denies. Cannonball hits right between her legs. She doesn't move. She stays right there on the porch in defiance. Clearly a Texas woman, I guess. But anyway, so she refused. They finally drag her off the porch, throw her in prison. She ends up dying as a result of the abuse that she received. I mean, story after story after story. They gave everything for us, folks. They were willing, knowing that it was a death sentence, to get up in silence, come forward, take the pen, dip it in the ink, and sign beneath that amazing final sentence. It says, in support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Thankfully for us, they were willing to give all of their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, and they set up a system for us so that we can save freedom by giving just a little bit of our lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. A little bit of our time and our money and our willingness to speak the truth, write that letter to the editor, make that phone call, or whatever it might be. And I'm going to ask you to do that. I'm going to ask you to think today about what you can do to engage in the process to save freedom for the next generation. So many did it for us. Will you be willing to do the same thing? In fact, if you were called forward today, what would you do? Would you be willing to come forward, take the pen, dip it in the ink, and sign and pledge your life? Your fortune, your sacred honor, would you be willing to give that for your children's freedom and for future generations? I'm going to ask you to do just a little bit of that. And in fact, I'm going to encourage you to go to my website at rickgreen.com and sign the Declaration of Independence. But to do that, you have to make the pledge online. And the pledge is to give of your life by taking, remember I said study? We got to take a little bit of time and study. There's actually a book I want to recommend, Mark Levin's new book on Liberty Amendments. As I've taught the Constitution for years, I've taught these very amendments that he's talking about doing. Just 2 weeks ago, the book came out, and I believe the momentum's going to be there to get some things done to amend the Constitution to fix what's happening right now with this out-of-control federal government. So read that book and get educated on that. That's going to take you a few hours to do that. Take our Constitution class. Take you about 6 to 8 hours to take that Constitution class. And then start studying candidates. Get those voter guides. Every time you go vote, go to ChristianVoterGuide.com, print out the voter guides, and take them in just so that you know which candidate stands for what. You can't believe what they say. You've got to look at what they do, right? Didn't your mama ever teach you that? It's not what you say. It's what you do. So pay attention to what those candidates do, not just what they say. And then get involved in talking to other people. Be a committee of correspondence. Share with your friends and your family and the people in your life. God's giving you a realm of influence. Be willing to speak the truth. The Bible says if you know the truth and know what to do and you stay silent, that's a sin. Let's not be silent. Let's make sure our voice is heard. Listen to Wall Builders Live. We'll encourage you on a daily basis. We'll give you victories that are happening all across the country. We're not doomsdayers. We're going to encourage you about the bright future that we have if we'll simply stand up and let our voice be heard, and we'll connect with you in all those different technological ways. And then pass the torch. Teach your kids and your grandkids. Get them to Patriot Academy. Give them a chance to come in and live the life of a legislator for a week on the real House floor, in the real committee rooms. We teach them biblical worldview of government. We teach them strategy on how to win, speaking skills and media skills, all the things it takes to be effective in today's world, in today's society. And it's not enough for us to be right. We got to know how to win, right? The men of Issachar understood the times, and they knew what to do. That's what we do at Patriot Academy. So I encourage you to check that out. We also have veterans come in and ceremonially at our graduation pass the torch to these 16 to 25-year-olds and say, hey, I was willing to die for you. Now it's time for you to go live that freedom and protect it. And then last, your sacred honor. Well, oh, I forgot, your fortune. Yeah, get out of debt so you're not dependent on government. Work on that. And tithe. Make sure that you're tithing. Make sure that your church is equipped with the ability to be the epicenter of the community. New Hope does that better than anybody, but you need to make sure that you're giving in a way that will allow them to do it even in an even greater way. The reason government has gotten bigger is because we haven't done our job personally helping other people and through our churches helping other people. So part of the way we turn this thing around is make sure that we're tithing and giving to charity and then invest in freedom. So last thing, Just speak out. Just be willing to let that voice be heard. Don't be intimidated by these folks that say, if you say anything's right and wrong, you're a bigot and all that kind of stuff. Be willing to say, I'm going to speak truth and let the chips fall where they may. Truth doesn't change just because people out there want to try to change the definition. They can change the dictionary all they want. Truth does not change. And we need a generation willing to stand up and speak truth, willing to stand up and fight for freedom, willing to honor the sacrifice of those who came before us, who preserved the torch of freedom on their watch and passed it to us. Now we get to stand guard at the watchtower of freedom. Friends, that's a privilege. That is an honor. Let's respect the sacrifice of others by making sure that we guard that torch on our watch, making sure that someday when history writes its chapter on us, that they do not say of our generation that it was on our watch that the torch of freedom was only dimly lit or, God forbid, extinguished. I pray that doesn't happen on our watch. I believe that based on what I see in your church and with your pastor and things I'm watching happen across the country, I'm more optimistic than I've ever been, because there is a prairie fire starting across the country right now. There's a fire of passion for righteousness and for getting this thing back to a constitutional republic that honors God. I believe what history is actually going to say of us when it's all said and done, Lord willing, they're going to say that on our watch, that torch of freedom burned even brighter than it ever had before. God bless you guys. Thanks for letting the Green family join you.